Back to My Garden, episode 57.
Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
Attention garden lovers. Do you want to save time, save money, and have your most incredible garden ever? Receive free tips, strategies, and gardening techniques from gardeners around the world. Join the VIP club for free today at www.backtomygarden.com/VIP. Hi, it's Dave. Two quick announcements. All of the links will be up on this episode at www.backtomygarden.com/57. And this year's top 20 garden writers list is up at www.backtomygarden.com/top20. Oh yeah, this year, they're all women. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. I'm Dave Ledoux, and welcome to another edition of Back to My Garden. Today, we have a fantastic guest. We're going all the way across the pond to jolly old England. Sarah believes in community and loves the country life. She loves teaching about keeping chickens, making cider, growing your own food, and artisan cooking skills, and beekeeping, and raised garden beds. We have so much to talk about. I want to welcome from Brentford, near West London in England, Sarah Ward. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me on today.
I'm excited to chat about gardening with you, and I've given the listeners a little overview and an introduction. Can you take a minute and tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into gardening?
Okay, well, my background, I was born and brought up in East London, and I went to school there. And when I left school, I went into the City of London, working in banking, particularly in international banking and foreign exchange dealing. And that was fun for a while. And then I thought, you know what, I can't spend my entire life in an office. I then took a vocation gap year out. And really, it was when my husband and I had our first child that we started to think more about gardening. We'd got a home that had a garden, and in particular, a focus was on growing food.
Wow. I'm going to take notes. For those of you driving, Sarah and I are going to chat. You guys drive, and I'll take the notes for you. And it'll be up on the blog at Back to My Garden. First of all, you have to follow Sarah on Twitter, at Hen Corner, and it's spelled just like it sounds. And that is a brilliant brand that is you've got across Facebook, and then of course your blog. Actually, it's way more than a blog. It's more like a resource site at www.hencorner.com.
Absolutely. And YouTube as well. We've got a whole stack of films that we've made to help people explore the country life when they're living in an urban environment themselves.
Can we start there? Because at first I thought, okay, we're going to talk about, you're almost like on a farm, but you're in one of the biggest cities on earth.
Yeah, we are. We are. We're in London town in England, and we're halfway between Harrods, the famous department store, and Heathrow, the busy airport. So our house is an old Victorian terraced house that was originally built for the local dock workers, because we're not far from the River Thames, and the houses have been in this area. They were built in 1880, so they've been around for quite a long time. And we've got, fortunately, a corner plot, so we've got a slightly bigger garden, hence the name Hen Corner. And when we're out in the garden and we're tending the hens and the other things that we have out there, we often have the planes flying above our heads, and we can almost read the numbers underneath them because they're that close.
Wow. Your neighbours are on both sides?
Yep, we've got neighbours both sides.
Have they become friends of your garden? Like, do you share your bounty with them?
Well, one of our neighbours actually had already started growing fruit and vegetables way before we'd even moved in. So she's got a really nice kitchen garden herself. They haven't got any livestock. We haven't got any bees or chickens. And they haven't got, I don't think they've got as many fruit trees as us, but they're really good. And we'll often exchange plants or produce, and they might give me some courgettes for a chutney. Now, what do you call courgettes over there?
You have aubergines and courgettes, and we have eggplants and zucchini.
There you go. See, I wasn't going to pronounce it because I've seen it written down, but I'm not too sure on the pronunciation.
Zucchini.
So she might give us some plants and some vegetables, and we'll give them a jar of chutney or some eggs. Particularly if the chickens are a bit noisy, I do like to repay my neighbours back with eggs just so that they can see the benefit of keeping chickens in London.
We have to take you back, Sarah, to the stressful international banking job. I assume you had a desk and you had to, did you commute on the tube? Or did you
absolutely
drive?
Yeah. Absolutely. And we've got the underground system in London. It's very old, and there's one particular line called the Central Line, and it goes from East London to West London and right through the City of London, where there are several stops where you can get off if you're working in the international banking or the big head offices of the banking and financial institutes. And that tube journey in the summer was horrendous, so hot, and then in the winter, so cold.
The last time I was in London was just before they banned drinking on the tube.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'd never seen a person drinking Guinness at breakfast. But, he probably had worked all night and that was his dinner.
And or maybe he didn't have a home to go to. And actually staying on the tube is a way of keeping warm if you haven't got a home.
So you're in this fast-paced corporate lifestyle.
Yep.
And now you're in this oasis with chickens and bees and gardens. Take us back. What was the first baby step to plotting your escape?
Okay, well, I knew I couldn't spend my whole life in a 9-to-5 office job. So I did a vocation training course, which a bit like a gap year, although I was 21 when I did it, and came from East London to West London specifically to support the local community. I was working with a local church and we were running holiday clubs, kids projects, a whole load of stuff in the local community. And I just had a sense of life and people and community and being outdoors a lot of the time just was so different from being stuck in an office. And when my year out had finished, I thought, I want to stay here. I've started to invest into this community. I want to put down roots. I want to raise a family here. I want my family to be part of the community. And then the gardening really came out of having a family, having our own home and garden, and looking to not just do stuff for ourselves in the garden, but build a sense of community around the garden as well, which is how we've now ended up much further on in the journey, being able to run courses and invite guests to come to the garden and share in what we're doing on a regular basis.
Brilliant. I try to explain to my friends here in Canada, like when you think of Canadians, you think of hockey. I say, if England had a sport after rugby and football, it would be gardening.
Absolutely. But do you know what? The demographic of gardeners has changed so much, because if you look back sort of 20 years ago, the gardeners would be older, retired gentlemen that would be escaping their families to their sheds at the end of the garden, and they would have their little secret harvests of their plants that they would lovingly tender and nurture. And now the demographic has changed so much. There are so many young people, women as well as men, whole families. It's really big in the local schools, and people are really getting to grips, particularly with where their food is coming from, and no longer happy to rely on packets and tins and frozen goods from the supermarket.
Oh yeah, I had a few traditional English breakfasts over there. There's no vegetables to be seen other than the deep fried tomato.
Absolutely.
We don't
eat those every day, I promise you. I know it's called a full English breakfast, but for the average family, you might have it two or three times a year.
I understand. There's no way. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, imagine a giant platter that you would have at Christmas or Thanksgiving, and it's just got about 3 pounds of food on it, like eggs and tomatoes and chips and baked beans and blood pudding and sausages and
bacon.
It was just incredible.
Yeah.
My wife and I joke, we get a channel called BBC Canada, which are your old hand-me-down television shows. And there's a show called Keeping Up Appearances with Hyacinth Bouquet.
Yes.
She makes Richard wear a tie when he goes out to garden.
Absolutely.
And anytime my bottom lip is sticking out, like I don't want to go move dirt or something, she says, go put on a tie before you go in the garden. And we both laugh.
Absolutely.
You didn't start off with chickens in your garden, though, did you? You worked your way up as a progression?
Yes. So the house that we're in now, as I said, has got a corner plot. So we've got a larger than average London garden. Now, compare it to a country garden and it's quite small. But for London, it is larger than average. And when we were in our previous house, which was in the same street, for a few doors down the road, but it had just a small terrace garden, we decided we wanted to start producing some of our own food. We'd become aware of the issues around sourcing food. We'd recognised the impact on the environment, pesticides, organic food, the impact on wildlife, animal welfare, you know, fair trade food miles, just the implications and the ethics around just food goes on forever. We discovered that once you've learnt something, you've had a question answered, you can't unknow it. So if your question has left you with an uncomfortable feeling, I mean, I don't know what the situation is in Canada, but an issue that's been very big in England has been our dairy farmers, where the supermarkets are buying their milk in bulk, but the supermarkets will dictate how much they're prepared to pay. And often it's just not enough to keep the farm alive. And farmers are closing down. They can't afford to feed their cows because of the income from the supermarket is just not enough. So there's all these issues that we were aware of with food. And we thought, well, whilst we try to source food ethically, surely being able to produce some of our own food on our own land will have the minimum impact on the environment, the maximum taste. It's going to be cheap. It's going to be guaranteed free from pesticides. It's going to have no food miles, no packaging. And that's really where we started. I don't think we would ever have expected to have got where we are now. And I don't know how much the next 5-10 years will hold. But I remember growing some tomatoes and just biting into them and thinking that they tasted so different from the supermarket tomatoes. And we started with what we would consider to be easy crops here. So I will say courgettes again. You can translate that for your listeners. We grew some potatoes. But I sort of reached the sort of plateau with just fruit and veg, and I wanted to create a whole meal from the garden. I wanted one plate, just one meal where I knew that every single thing on that plate had come from the garden and had had no negative ethical impact on anybody else, just pure reward. So that was really the beginning of the journey, and it's just moved on from there. So we started with fruits and vegetables. In our smaller garden, we did have our first two chickens, and then as we've moved to a bigger house, a bigger garden, we've been able to really expand all the different things that we're doing to try and produce food from as many different food groups as possible with the variety that comes with that. And obviously you mentioned beekeeping. The bees are not just for producing honey, but the bees are the most fantastic pollinators. So we're seeing bumper yields of our fruit and vegetables because we've got the bees in the back garden helping us.
Folks, I told you, Sarah is amazing. You have to go to her website at www.hencorner.com. Follow her on social media. You'll realize, teacher, you have teaching in your blood.
My parents were both teachers.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
You have some accolades on your website. You've been pretty high profile. Media has found an interest in your story.
Yes. We've had radio. We've had a radio presenter has been on a course and then did an interview after that. We've had the BBC, flagship, the British Broadcasting Corporation, have been down here, and they filmed our chickens for a special Easter edition of their program, The One Show. And they were looking at what comes first, the chicken or the egg, and they were having eggs hatching in the studio live during their program, but they came out to visit us as London chicken keepers to find out what it was like to keep chickens all the way through past the chick stage. We've got some fantastic magazines that we've worked with, and it's been great because whilst we're on a journey ourselves, we really want to encourage others to join us on the journey to see if there are elements of living the country life in London, or translate that as any urban environment, if they can incorporate some of that into their day-to-day lives and reap the benefits and the rewards of doing so.
Sarah, the listeners want to know, because you're busy teaching and, you know, you have a a busy life. Did you get to garden much this year? And what was your garden like?
Okay, now this year in England, we've had the most fantastic weather. We had a very mild winter, which meant that the bees were behaving as though it was June in April, and we had them swarming a good month or so before they should have done. But unfortunately, earlier on in the year, I wasn't very well, so I haven't done as much gardening as I wanted to this year. But we've taken the opportunity, whilst not that much has been growing in the kitchen garden, to replace the raised beds, because we had them the raised beds built out of wood, and within 2 or 3 years, the wood had started to rot and biodegrade, and they were starting to fall apart. And I thought, forget this, if I've got to replace this wood every 4 years, this is going to be more building work than gardening. So we've managed to find this fantastic product, which is wooden planks made out of recycled plastic, and it's literally the household plastic and milk bottles, yogurt pots, carrier bags. It all gets melted down, and they make these timber planks, and we're rebuilding the kitchen garden with these timber planks and the plastic timber, and this will last for years and years and years. Our pathways are brick, and so we've spent some time this year restoring the kitchen garden, and we've still had a good harvest. Something that's been very, very popular this year, that's grown in abundance because it overwintered with our mild winter, are inkaberries. Now, inkaberries are also known as Cape gooseberries, and also known as, I think, Phasalis. Are you familiar with this plant?
I grew 2 giant Cape gooseberries this year.
There you go.
With the little lantern around the fruit?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I found that they've been a fantastic crop this year, particularly because they've overwintered and we've had a very mild year. But I've actually got what was once 2 little plants, the size of tomato plants last year. They've actually grown and have completely taken over 2 of my raised beds. And so I'm trying to develop recipes to use them, because in England, we tend to just have them sitting on top of a cheesecake in a posh restaurant. And I think, nope, I've got buckets of the things. So I've created this inkaberry jelly, which obviously we can't buy anywhere in England. And I've actually sold all the jars that I've got. I've got a waiting list of people wanting some more inkaberry jelly. So I'm waiting for the next lot of harvest, because they're continually ripening and enabling me to gather more by the bucket load.
So the inkaberries brought you joy.
Absolutely.
Was there anything that frustrated you in the garden this year?
I think I'm still learning as a beekeeper, and you always learn as a beekeeper. I've been really fortunate that some of the beekeepers in my local association who are helping me, mentoring me, very, very experienced. I'll do a bit of name dropping here. One of our beekeepers, his name is John Chappell. He has spent many years being the president of the National Honey Show, which is sort of the flagship competition for beekeepers throughout the UK. But he also is the beekeeper for Her Majesty the Queen. And he goes to Buckingham Palace and to the Royal Parks and looks after her bees. So I've been very fortunate that he's been able to help me. But we've got some other local beekeepers that have been able to help. And this year, as I've been learning, having somebody alongside me, making some suggestions. Our bees, we started off with 3 colonies over winter. The colony of bees is a family of bees, each colony in a separate hive. And I was planning to give 1 colony away to some friends, and the colony had got so big I couldn't even get them in the travel box. And then before I'd moved them, one of the other colonies had swarmed and had become 2 colonies. So then I'd had 4 colonies. Then I gave 1 away. Then I gave 2 away. Then another colony had swarmed. Then I split a colony. And I thought, how many colonies of bees have I ended up with? So my friend helped, and we had 4 smaller colonies slowly plodding along. We've moved them back together. We've merged 4 colonies into 2 colonies, and fortunately now this year I've had my biggest ever honey harvest, so it's gone right in the end, and I'm certainly going to learn from my ups and downs with the bees at the beginning of the year and put some of that I've learned into practice, and hope that we'll have a smoother year of beekeeping next year, because a swarm of bees in London is a little bit more tricky than having a swarm of bees in the countryside.
I've become an evangelist for bee pollen and local honey for people with health issues.
Absolutely.
I'm going, why aren't people talking about honey in school? It's a miracle food.
Absolutely. Well, we invite schools and groups of children to come here to Hen Corner, to our back garden. But also I go into schools and I do schools lessons, and I take in my beekeeping equipment, and I take in a slideshow of the bees and how they work and how the colony works and the family and the life cycle of the bee and the year in the life of the bees, and the kids find it absolutely fascinating. In fact, just this evening I've had a group of beaver scouts. So you know there's a Boy Scout movement. Mm-hmm. The youngest group we have here are beavers, and I think they're about 6, 7, 8 years old. And I've had a group of 25 of them have come to the garden specifically to look at how food is produced, because unless you're going to a farm, and there's not too many farms right in the middle of London, a lot of children just think food comes from the supermarket. So to be able to come here to see the chickens, to collect the eggs, to see the food that's growing in the kitchen garden, to look at the trees and the fruit on the trees, it's a fantastic experience. And they love hearing about the bees. They love trying on bee suits and looking at the frames, the wax that the bees have made, and then tasting the honey. They love it. They absolutely love it.
My goodness. I was going to ask you, you have the full suit and the gloves and the headgear and the fogger?
Absolutely.
You're incredible.
And I've got 6 spare sets because I run courses, because what I've discovered is whilst for me and my family, we've been learning on a journey, a step at a time, we've learned stuff that we can share with others. We can give people other opportunities. So when I've done my training to be a beekeeper, I initially trained on a farm down in the countryside in Devon. And I thought, oh, this is great. This is interesting. But how do I translate that to my back garden in London? So the courses that we run here are specifically for people living in urban environments to think, well, I love the idea of that, but how can I actually do it in my own space with the limitations that I have? And we say, look, come along, come and see. Look, there's different sized chicken houses. Which one will fit in your garden? There's different types of beehives. You can have it in your garden. You can have it on your roof. You can put it on an allotment. You can have it elsewhere. And just giving people the opportunity to experience, to put a bee suit on, to help me inspect the bees, to hold a frame of bees, because you need to go into it slowly. It's not like sort of going shopping one day, oh, I think I'll buy a beehive and I'll have some bees tomorrow. But we're talking sort of 60,000 insects that sting, and you don't go into that lightly. So for the guests on our courses, they've got the opportunity in full protective clothing to come with me to the hive, and they can hold a frame of bees, and the frame of bees will have maybe 10,000 bees per frame, and they can hold those and look at them and discover what's going on. They can identify the girl bees, the boy bees. They can see the queen bee, hopefully. They can see where the bees are storing food, where they're raising new baby bees, where they're raising the brood. And it's a great opportunity for people to just come and have a bit of a taster and see if it's something they want to pursue themselves and take things a step further and make that a decision for themselves.
Brilliant. You know, Sarah, I glanced at the clock and our time is just whipping by. Now is the time in the show where we play a game called 5 Quick Questions.
Okie dokie.
This is your chance to share your wisdom and experience with novice gardeners. Are you ready to play?
Okay, yes.
Question number 1, in your opinion, what do you think stops most people from trying gardening for the first time?
Well, in my opinion, here in London, people say, I haven't got the time and I haven't got the space.
Rubbish.
I would encourage them, you know, even if you just grow a pot of basil on the windowsill, once you've nurtured that plant, particularly if you've nurtured it from seed and then you're eating something that you've grown yourself, that even that is the first step. And you'll find that if you can manage that, then you'll want to try the next thing and you can take it bigger and better.
Do you remember the first thing you grew?
Oh, probably as a child. Oh, where most children in the UK grow something called cress. Do you have cress in Canada?
Yes.
There you go. And you normally grow it on a bit of paper towel, sometimes in an old empty eggshell or a yogurt pot. And you need to make sure that it's wet enough, but not too wet. Don't let it dry out. And then you can cut it with a pair of scissors and sprinkle it into a sandwich.
I've become, you know, we grow a lot of heirloom tomatoes, but I've started to grow hot peppers.
Mm.
And I thought about your bee suit. I might need to borrow it because some of my peppers, when you cut into them, it's like a cloud of poisonous gas. It's so spicy.
Wow. Now, I've heard that chili and chili peppers are very good for deterring squirrels. My biggest problem at the moment in the garden is squirrels are taking all my harvest. I've got a lovely big almond tree, and they've taken every single nut off the tree.
Well, we're going to go off the outline here because I can help you. I'm your guy. My mother-in-law is from Greece.
Yep.
And she's an avid gardener. And this year, a couple of crazy squirrels have gotten into her garden, and they will take three bites out of a green pepper, throw it aside. Three bites out of a tomato, toss it. Mm-hmm. And they've started to eat her hot peppers.
And they're eating them?
Two or three bites, and then they chatter and throw them away. And my mother-in-law comes running out, screaming at him in Greek, waving her hands in the air, and it's hilarious, but she doesn't listen to the podcast. We've got her spray. It's mountain lion and coyote urine spray.
The thing is, if I spray my almond tree, surely I'll be eating it when I harvest the fruit for myself.
Well, she's just going to use it like a perimeter warning system. Apparently, all the rabbits and the groundhogs and the squirrels are afraid of coyotes and foxes and mountain lions.
Okay, now how does this work in London? Because we don't have coyotes or mountain lions, so I don't think the squirrels would recognize a coyote or a mountain lion. Now, foxes, we have loads of foxes in London, and they're after the chickens at night, and they're messing up on the lawn. Now, if I could get a spray that I could put around the perimeter of the garden that would deter foxes and squirrels, I'd be very happy.
Listeners, we have listeners all over the world. If you have access to fox urine spray, and I'm sure somebody does, visit Sarah at Twitter her at Hen Corner, or go to hencorner.com. I'm sure we can order you some online to scare away the squirrels.
Hey, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. Back to the five quick questions.
Back to the five questions.
Number two, what is the best gardening advice that you've ever personally received?
Now this is from a fantastic gardener that we have here called James Wong, and he trained at Kew Gardens, and he encourages people to grow incredible plants that are edible, so incredible edibles. And he's got some handy hints, and the best hint he's ever given is grow food that you like to eat, which sounds really, really simple. But the amount of people that grow swedes and turnips and loads of radishes, and they say, oh, look at this. Oh, no, but I don't like eating them. I don't know what to do with it now I've got it. I've got a friend of mine, and the daughter grew loads of pumpkins and wanted to give them to her classmates in October. And she had about 40 spare. And they said, I just don't know what to do with them. And I said, well, you can eat them. Oh, no, I don't know what to do. I don't want them. You can have them. And I made a lovely pumpkin and apple chutney out of them. But I think really, if you're going to take time to grow food, particularly if you're growing food, make sure it's something that you really like to eat, so you're going to really enjoy it and really appreciate it. It's really simple, but it's a really good bit of advice.
Do you have any chutney recipes on your website?
I do have some, and I've got a number that I need to put up there. So there are some on there at the moment, and there'll be some going up very soon.
My wife has become chutney obsessed, so we did a whole bunch of canning. And I love variety, so good.
It's a great way to, exactly what it says, it's a preserve. It preserves food, preserves our fruit and veg, makes it last for months and years even.
Did you do much canning, sorry?
I do. We always make a lot of jelly because we've got five apple trees, and we press the apples to make apple juice and cider. And once we've pressed the apples, the pulp that's left over, I boil that up, and that makes a fantastic pectin jelly. And then I add chilies to it, or Inca berries to it, or rhubarb to it, and that makes some lovely jams and jellies. But I also make three or four different types of pickles and chutneys each year, and I run courses for people to come and join us on a preserving day, and they get to take home one of each of the recipes that we've made. So I've done a couple of those recently, and they've been great fun.
Man, this call is not long enough, because I want to, we could talk for hours, because I bet you people come to you pretty nervous about canning if you've never done it before.
Yeah, I have people say, look, I grow tomatoes. They never quite get red. I've got loads of green tomatoes. I've heard you can make green tomato chutney, but I don't know how. And when they come and they see different techniques, different types of preserving, then they've enjoyed it. They've seen that it's really simple. I actually get them to do all the work. I'm not demonstrating it. They're doing it. And then they go home with the recipes thinking, I can do that again. I've done that. It worked. I can do it again at home. And I had a message on my website the other day on my Piccalilli recipe, and they said, oh, I've just made some of this, I can't wait, I know I've got to leave it for a couple of months to mature, but I want to eat it, I can't wait. And got some fantastic recipes that they're not difficult to make at all, and then they're very enjoyable. It's quite traditional in England to have pickles and chutneys on Boxing Day after Christmas. So you eat your cold meat after you've had your big Christmas dinner for Christmas, and then on Boxing Day the day after, cold meat and chutneys. So minimum cooking but maximum enjoyment.
In 2 days I'm going to a dinner party, and my friend has a microbrewery. He brews really nice beer. And he likes my wife's pickled beans, so I trade him pickled beans for beer.
Absolutely. We do a lot of trading. I've got friends that have allotments, and so they bring me over their gluts and extra fruit and veg that they've got too many of, and I give them eggs or give them cider or beer, and it's great to trade. And you enjoy it even more if you haven't had to pay money and you've watched it grow from the ground, and really good natural stuff, and it's just so rewarding.
Your eggs are cruelty-free, drug-free.
Oh, absolutely. They just come out of the chicken.
Yeah. Just try it, because when you go to the grocery stores over here, there's usually 6 to 8 categories of egg.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, same here.
And from disease-ridden, cruelty, filled with drugs.
I don't think they advertise them as that, though, do
no,
they?
No, I know. But I see people now, they're out of the free-range organic eggs, people will not buy the lower-grade eggs.
No, which is good. And what we found in the UK, there's been a number of high-profile celebrity chefs that have been really championing the cause of animal welfare. And there have been programs about chickens that are reared for meat or for eggs. There's been programs about pigs. They're often intensively reared here in the UK. And there's big campaigns. There's a big campaign about fish as well recently. And people are really tuning in and getting hold of this and saying, no, I know as a consumer, I've got power in my pound or dollar for you over there. And we make our decisions. We vote with our purses. And hopefully we will see a real change in farming. And I understand, we're in a small island here in the UK, and during the war we had rationing, but we pretty much managed to stay self-sufficient food wise. It wasn't the best variety of food, and people were desperate for bananas and oranges, but we were able to provide most of the food that our nation needs. Now we're only producing about 50-60% of the food for the people living here, for our communities. We're importing so much, we're dependent on other nations to feed us, which is a shame, because most plants to grow need rain and sunshine, and we don't get too much sunshine, but we get lots of rain in England. So we've got lots of green and lots of grass, and therefore the dairy cows should have lots to eat and make lots of milk. But I think people have gone for convenience, they've gone for maximum profits, and they're importing food and intensively rearing food, and the British people are starting to say, no, enough's enough. We're discovering, we're asking questions, our questions are often being answered with more questions. And I think there's a whole generation of people going on a journey of food, wanting to know where it comes from and making choices based on the provenance of the food and the ethics of its production.
Wow. My listeners are in love with you. I could talk to you all day. Oh, you have a great crystal clear message, too. You know what you stand for.
Yeah.
Oh, question 3. We're muddling through these. Okay, everybody who's listening to my voice, please go to Sarah's website at hencorner.com. Can you recommend one or two of your favorite websites for gardeners? Maybe a blog or a resource site?
Okay, there's a fantastic, I wouldn't call it a company. It started off as a project, it became a farm. We've got a fantastic place in the UK called River Cottage, and River Cottage is headed up by a chef called Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, and he's really championing the cause of getting back to basics with food, with its production, with eating a fantastic variety of food, making it from scratch. He's got a fantastic team around him which help with brewing and making your own alcoholic drinks, with preserving. He's got a team that help with foraging, knowing which mushrooms to pick and how you can get free food from the hedgerow, and they are really championing a fantastic cause. And we like to think that at Hen Corner we're trying to translate all that River Cottage do in the countryside and make it the same ethics and the same values for those of us that live in the urban environment here in London. So rivercottage.net is a fantastic resource, and they run training courses. They have got fantastic restaurants, they've got loads of books, they've got loads of videos, and they are heroes of ours. We love River Cottage, and in fact it was River Cottage down in Dorset where I first learned to keep bees, and I went on my training course down there, and we're real fans of River Cottage. So that's the first website. And the second website is friendsofthehoneybee.com. And as you said, we need to be more aware of bees, of the honeybee in particular, for its honey, as well as for the pollination and the impact on the environment if we were to lose our honeybees. So this is a fantastic new project, Friends of the Honeybee. It's part of the British Beekeeping Association, and it's encouraging people to understand more of the plight of the honeybee, encouraging honeybees to visit them in their own back garden.
Friendsofthehoneybee.com, right?
Yes, that's right.
Dynamite. Question four. Books. Can you recommend one of your favorite gardening books?
Oh, well, I am speaking to you from my conservatory, and we have got a whole shelf of books dedicated to gardens and chickens and bees, plants and growing your own. But do you know the book that I've found most helpful is a book from the Royal Horticultural Society. They're the big wigs here in England, and they've got this little book called An Allotment Journal, and it's a journal that you would write in. You would put your own notes of what you're growing and how you're succeeding and what worked and what didn't. But it's also got fantastic plants, where they best grow, how to nurture them, what to plant when, and that's been a real helpful guide that you can take it out with you. It's a great reference, but also a place where you can put your own notes and learn as you go, year on year.
Fantastic. Yeah, I bet you a lot of people don't keep gardening journals.
No, it's great. It's great to look back on and see what worked well. I try to practice a four-bed crop rotation with my raised garden so that you're growing different plants in the soil each year, which allows the soil to replenish itself. Some plants take out nitrogen, some plants fix it in, and you don't drain the soil of the nutrients you need if you're rotating. And you need to keep records for doing that, because you might end up rotating clockwise one year and anti-clockwise the next year, and you're ending up back in the same place.
You had mentioned the Cape gooseberry. On windy days, they just kind of blow all over the yard.
Oh, absolutely.
We had a few random rogue sprout in the spring, and we go, what are you doing there? You know, it just, I love it. Oh, question.
Do you leave them to grow, or do you?
Fowler repotted a few.
Yeah.
We have a dwarf version, kind of a distant cousin, called a ground cherry.
Oh, right.
Way much smaller, like a dwarf.
Yeah.
And because they're so low to the ground, the fruit blows all over the yard. I go around and pick them up, and then you kind of peel back. They have a tough time ripening. They don't get enough sun, so we have to kind of toss out the green ones and only keep the yellow ones.
Yes, yeah.
Question five, look into your crystal ball at next season. This is a fun question, and it's a two-parter. You can answer any way you like. Is there anything that you've been itching to experiment with in your garden, or What would you recommend every single gardener try to grow in their garden next season?
Right. Now, I would say that I love the Cape gooseberries, the inkaberries. I haven't found any disease or pest that rots them, and they're just so virulent. But I think having had them for 2 years and not having space to grow anything else, I wouldn't worry if they didn't do a third season. Do you know something that I do encourage people to have a go? Something that is just so faithful and so delicious is asparagus. And we love growing asparagus here. It does take a while. So if the question really is next year, you can plant it next year, but you won't be able to harvest it for 2 or 3 years. But once the beds are established, they will feed you fantastic fresh asparagus for about 20 years. So that's a real top tip. If you've got space to plant some asparagus, very, very minimum attention that it needs, but it gives you the most amazing harvest.
Sarah, you have done incredible. You've been a brilliant guest.
Oh, thank you.
Just a reminder, all the listeners, please follow on Twitter at Hen Corner. And on Facebook and on YouTube, all the social media sites, and share Sarah's teaching and her photographs, and of course, support her blog at www.hencorner.com. I want to give you the last word to the listeners today. Can you leave us with either a pearl of wisdom or a note of encouragement?
Do you know, we've been talking about the garden and Hen Corner. This is only a part of my life. I've got a day job. I volunteer. We're a busy London family. There used to be a programme on the BBC called The Good Life, and it was a couple who gave up their day jobs and ploughed up the lawn and decided to become self-sufficient and gave up all the routine that everybody else did. But I've got a day job. My husband runs a business. So we're busy. But I really believe that that we can have a full life, and if we have a full life, living life to the full, it's just so abundant. And yes, we get busy, and yes, we get tired, but it's an investment that's so worthwhile, so rewarding, that if you're one of those gardeners that right at the beginning we said you haven't got the time, you haven't got the space, I'd encourage you just to make that investment, because it's a fantastic reward.
You've been fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dave. It's been great chatting to you.